You're listening to KCBS In-Depth.
Really, in order to find quality care, you often have to be on a wait list that's months long.
The people, places, and issues the Bay Area's talking about.
The aggressive advocates who were looking to overrule Roe for so long, they really had no idea of the consequences they might be opening up.
In this case, there very well may be charges that are appropriate. For example, trying to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, right? That is unlawful.
This is KCBS In-Depth.
In 2022, a report by the Stanford Lancet Commission stated that the opioid crisis stands out as one of the most devastating public health disasters of the 21st century in the United States and Canada. Not much has occurred since then to shift that belief. The opioid crisis, involving fentanyl in particular, continues to dominate our conversations. The end of 2023 saw over 750 drug overdose deaths in San Francisco alone, with fentanyl making up more than 81% of those deaths. So how did we get here? How did fentanyl take over the drug market and become so devastating to so many? Welcome to KCBS In-Depth, broadcasting throughout the Bay Area and streaming on the Odyssey app. I'm Mary Hughes. For a closer look at all this, I'm joined by Sam Quiñones, freelance journalist and author of books about the opioid epidemic. His most recent book is The Least of Us: True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. Sam, I want to thank you so much for joining me on In-Depth for this conversation. Thank you.
My pleasure, Mary. Thanks for having me.
I think when a lot of people are thinking about fentanyl, to them, it seems like a new drug that's taking over all conversations about addiction, about overdoses. And it can seem to people like this crisis kind of came out of nowhere, but there's always a longer history to these things. And from all the investigative journalism work that you've done in this area and in this arena, what's been the path of fentanyl? How did this drug get its beginnings?
Well, I mean, people are right that this it is dominating the conversation nationwide in the United States about drug addiction and drug smuggling out of Mexico. Fentanyl is actually been around for decades. It's a magnificent drug when used surgically. It is used in cardiac surgery. I've had it myself. I had a heart attack in 2017. They gave me fentanyl. And it's been a workhorse. It's allowed for the kinds of surgeries that never would have been able to be done with other forms of anesthetics. It's a magnificent anesthetic. And one reason for that is because it takes you in and out of anesthesia very quickly. So you're not doped up for hours as you would be on morphine. There are other benefits to it, but it's become a workhorse drug for decades now. It grew to be noticed by the drug trafficking underworld out of Mexico in the mid-2000s as they were beginning to supply what was then we've called the opioid epidemic, which people getting addicted to heroin, but starting first with the massive supplies of prescription painkillers unleashed by pharma companies and doctors on the country. The Mexican trafficking world began to supply heroin to meet that need. Those drugs, those opioids, are chemical cousins to heroin. And so people began to get addicted to the pills, then switched to heroin. Some subset of those folks did. Along the way, the Mexican trafficking world discovered that there was such a thing as what they used to call synthetic heroin, heroin made only from chemicals, no plants involved. This was what they used to call fentanyl. And they figured this out in 2006. And then The Least of Us had told the story of the first chemist who kind of clued them in that they hired actually to make precursor drugs to methamphetamine. He decides instead to make fentanyl. They know what fentanyl is. They get mad, but he explains to them, this is the most profitable underworld drug that has ever been invented, and you'll thank me. And in fact, they did. They began to figure out fentanyl was was this just monumentally profitable then. And as time went on over the next 10 years more, up to the present, the trafficking world in Mexico has gradually figured out, and now very completely figured out, that fentanyl is a much better alternative than heroin. You don't have to grow any poppies. You make it only from chemicals. They control the shipping ports on the western side of Mexico, plus the Mexico City airport, to the extent they need to get almost unlimited quantities of the precursors to come from China to make fentanyl, also to make methamphetamine, it's worth noting. And so what you've been seeing is that the Mexican trafficking world took over really from the Chinese chemical companies, which were the first to begin to supply fentanyl, but they were supplying in such small quantities that because they were mailing it through the mail, they never really covered more than the first initial states that began the opioid epidemic, which would be, you know, Ohio, Kentucky, West Virginia, Tennessee, places like that, Indiana. It was only when the Mexicans figured it out and began getting these staggering quantities of precursor chemicals that allowed them to make fentanyl in the quantities that we're now seeing, that they began, that they spread fentanyl coast to coast. So now you were seeing fentanyl, and again, methamphetamine, I think it's worth noting, coast to coast. You're seeing it in Maine, you're seeing it in Skid Row, LA, you're seeing it up and down, all over San Francisco, of course, many places, virtually every place in the country has some fentanyl supply. But this all began with the Mexican trafficking world trying to supply heroin to what was then our burgeoning opioid addict market, which was created, in fact, by this overprescribing of those pain pills going back to the mid-90s.
Well, that's one of your earlier books was focused on the opioid side of things from that prescription side of the world. Was that your first kind of foray into looking at how our world is, I guess, becoming addicted to this particular type of drug? Was that your first delving into that?
Yeah, and it grew really from living in Mexico for 10. I lived in Mexico for 10 years, came back, got a job at the LA Times. And at the LA Times, we saw the drug war in Mexico just explode among the different cartels that were in place then. And so I was put on a team to cover that war. As it got more and more sadistic, more and more brutal, I began to realize that there was this new burgeoning heroin market, which I could not explain. Why would we have more people using heroin? I thought heroin was the drug from the past. We'll go back to it. And along the way, I began to write about in my book, Dreamland. One of the story threads in the book, Dreamland, was about a town in Mexico where everybody came here to sell heroin. In fact, very much like pizza delivery, you know, like the retail pizza delivery. I'll sell you a tenth of a gram. You call up, I'll go meet you and sell you a bunch of tenth of a gram doses of heroin. Along the way, though, I could not explain why that was happening. And then I realized I was really dealing with the very small story. The much, much larger story was the story of how the opioid epidemic, it began, meaning drug companies pushing the idea that doctors now needed to prescribe opioid prescription painkillers, legitimate pain pills, but with an alarming new aggressivity, let's say, just really relentlessly, and refills. And this began in the mid-1990s on the idea that science somehow now knew that these drugs could not be addictive to people who were in pain. And that was proven to be really quite untrue. And so I did not understand this at the time. I was living in Mexico. I did not know what an OxyContin was or a Vicodin was. And it was only as I began to fill in that part of the story, which I had missed because I was in Mexico, that I understood why we had this burgeoning heroin market and that heroin traffickers out of Mexico could now be doing banner business.
Well, I am always interested in the trajectory of things, how something gets to what we, you know, the common person is aware and knows what's going on and hears about it all the time. But how did we get there? And one point that you mentioned so far that I don't think I had thought of really is the fact that a big part of that change was coming from how these drugs can be produced, how they can be created. Because if you don't need land, if you don't need all of that, that streamlines your market.
Absolutely. You reduce your supply chain. You don't need you don't need rain or sunlight. What you do need is access to chemical precursors. And if you control the ports, as they do, to the extent they need to import, really just, it's just remarkable the quantities of these precursor chemicals, both for fentanyl and for methamphetamine, that the Mexicans are able to get through from Chinese supplier companies. What that means is that you can make these drugs. There are no seasons anymore synthetic drugs, and so you can make these drugs like all year round, you know, all day long, you know, all week long. I mean, and if you have the chemicals for it, and that's exactly what's been happening. And so now we see, because of this ability to make things all year round, we are seeing things we've never seen before. For example, we are now seeing almost no difference in drug stories region to region. Used to be you go from one place to another 200-300 miles away, and there'd be very different drug stories, though that's gone. Used to be that we had cycles of drug use in America. Used to be we'd have stimulants and then depressants and then stimulants again, and they'd last like 10 years, 12 years, whatever. Now that's completely done. A stimulant and a depressant, methamphetamine and fentanyl, are now being made by the same people, sold to other people. Those people are selling it to other people, and it's being used by people all across the country. And so now coroners are very commonly finding meth and fentanyl in the same bloodstream. It used to be, when I started out as a crime reporter in Stockton, California, there were meth users and there were heroin users, and they did not mix. In fact, they kind of disliked each other for their choice of drugs and that kind of thing. All of that has been changed as well, largely because this is a supply question, simply supply creating demand, and the supply has been unrelentless. It's not a new wave of drugs. I liken it to kind of a new high tide of drugs.
In Depth will return after a moment. A conversation that I had last year with someone, with a doctor, was about the overdose side of things when it comes to fentanyl and, you know, the type of outreach that they're doing to communities and to the unhoused community to try to reach people with information. And we did talk a little bit about how fentanyl is being mixed into other drugs and whether a person's aware of it or not. They could be taking something that has fentanyl in it and the effects that it has on the body. And that got me thinking a lot about the addictive aspects of fentanyl, of the powerfulness of this drug. How does it compare to other hard drugs that in the past we might have said, oh, this is the drug you need to be, you know, scared of using, or if you come into contact with?
I would say that fentanyl, because of how quickly it gets to the brain, again, it takes you into anesthesia and out of it. The same thing happens with its use illicitly. And so it gets you very, very quickly, and then it gets out of there very quickly too, which means that you are constantly having cravings, particularly as the supply is so vast, your tolerance rises and rises and rises to levels never seen with heroin. That's why there's very little heroin on the streets of America anymore, because it doesn't fill the gap. It doesn't, you know, do what an addict needs to have done, which is get rid of the withdrawal symptoms. Once you're addicted to fentanyl, you are at a whole other level of tolerance. And of course, all this has to do with the fact that it is just simply so prevalent. There's so much supply coming in out of Mexico, creating these new levels of tolerance. You know, now they're mixing fentanyl, and it's been several years now, where they've been mixing fentanyl into counterfeit pills that look like a Xanax bar or Percocet or Vicodin or what have you, you know. And these pills are coming in now in the tens of millions, which shows you kind of the supply that's available to the traffickers down in Mexico. And what's also happening is the tolerances are just staggering now. So in Tucson, a while back, and in Tucson, there's They're, you know, they're routinely addicts coming into clinics who are smoking 50 to 70 to 80 pills a day, you know? And so it creates addiction, but then it very quickly takes you up to very high levels of addiction. And that is one of the terrors. That's why so many people, I believe, refuse treatment on the streets. They're offered treatment. No, this woman said something very important, I think, at a conference I was at, and we were talking, and she said, my client, she's a drug counselor, and she said, my clients are afraid of two things. Number one, they're afraid of dying on fentanyl. Number two, they are terrified of being away from fentanyl because the withdrawals are so brutal. And in fact, you actually need now, I believe, medical supervision to withdraw from fentanyl. And it's the same kind of addiction that you would get from heroin and other opioids, except for that the supplies are so vast and the drug is just so potent. It hits your brain so much quicker. And so all of this means that it's a whole other kind of level too of addiction that we are seeing. And because it's so prevalent, we're seeing this, you know, nationwide. As I have contacts in Maine who are talking about the fentanyl problem over there, you know, that kind of thing. So this is something that we've never seen before, really. And I think a lot of it is just connected exactly up to the fact that the supply of this stuff is just so, so vast.
Well, and that does bring me to a bigger point, I think, where we are talking about the supply and demand and the fact that so much is coming into our country, just everywhere. As you said, this isn't just a particular area where, you know, we see what it's doing here in the Bay Area, but this is happening all over. On the political front, you know, recently we had the APEC, the conference was in San Francisco late last year, and you had the United States and China saying they want to work together to stop the flow of fentanyl. There's also, you know, coming together to say the same for the United States and Mexico. Is this considered a first step too late?
Well, of course, this is something they should have been doing sooner. I guess I applaud the public nature of this commitment and so on. I think that's a good, it can only be a good thing, really. I want to see what then comes of it. I don't know the Chinese government all that well, but I did live in Mexico for 10 years and I follow Mexico fairly closely still. And my feeling is that there's not much commitment from Mexico on this topic at all. On the contrary, there's all kinds of hiding the head in the sand. Both countries have their part to their cross to bear, the blame that they need to shoulder in all of this. But it's clear that Mexico is not doing what it needs to do to make sure that the chemicals coming into the country are legitimate and they're headed to legitimate sources and all that kind of stuff. And so my feeling is that good, glad that happened, but and I'm waiting to see what concrete measures are adopted by all countries. One of the things that absolutely needs to happen, in my opinion, is and one thing that allows for the impunity down in Mexico to exist among these traffickers to be able to make whatever they want as long all year round is the sale of assault weapons here in the United States. Those weapons, many of them are smuggled south to Mexico in small quantities. It's not like truckloads of guns. It's always like cars have 5 or 10 guns at a time, but they make a huge difference over months and months and months. And these are going to frequently to traffickers to ensure their impunity. And so the price of meth is almost like the flip side of the ease with which these guns are purchased in the United States. The lower it gets, the easier those guns are must be to buy, that kind of thing. That's kind of how I think about it now.
Well, and, you know, we can look to how governments respond both on a major level, on a global level, and then even, you know, within the state and how politicians will say what they say, and you can hope something good comes out of what they're saying and commitments, as you said, that they make. But it, you know, this is really a tale of what this is doing to communities of people.
Yeah.
And I think a lot about what communities try to do to combat crises when they occur. And so what have you seen as a response from communities who are dealing with these drugs like fentanyl, like meth, and yeah. what they're doing to people? And, you know, what do you think are methods that they can take on to yeah. to help themselves, basically?
Well, I think one of the things that's created the fentanyl problem, in my opinion, having done so much research on this and interviewing on this, is that this begins to happen, goes nationwide, just as a lot of communities are decriminalizing the sale, at least, of fentanyl. I think that's a very misguided idea. It's shown itself to be very misguided. Selling anything containing fentanyl, and everything contains fentanyl now, is tantamount to firing a gun into a crowd. It's like, you know, you're going to hurt somebody, and it's likely you're going to kill somebody. That's a known fact. I don't believe that it is a wise move. And I do believe that we need to make greater use of law enforcement in a variety of ways. People say, well, that's a continuation of the drug war. And I say, no. The drug war was, to the extent it had problems, it was because, not because we used law enforcement, it's because we only used law enforcement. And that's a really important distinction. We need a variety of actors, of service, of all, and so you're, but law enforcement has to be a part of it in many ways. Interdiction, absolutely. Absolutely, creating consequences for selling something as deadly as fentanyl. I don't see how you can actually argue with that, honestly. But I also believe that one of the places I think we're seeing some very interesting work is in the rethinking of jail when it comes to these two drugs. The main problem that people have is that they cannot get away from these drugs on the street. What we need is a place where people can go where they cannot leave when the dope tells them that they must. And jail has become that place in many counties. What's happening in many counties, I think, is very interesting is to watch, is that they are rethinking how jail is done. So parts of those jails are now recovery pods, essentially the exact same services you would get if you were outside on the street in a treatment center, with any meetings and classes and anger management and physical exercise and all the rest. You're doing all of that, except for that in jail, you can't leave when the drugs tell you you must. And that is a huge thing. It is not compassionate. It's somehow been misconstrued as compassion to leave people on the street. I do not see how that is at all possible to think, you know. So I think that we need to rethink a lot. We are applying right now ideas that originated before the pervasive spread of fentanyl and methamphetamine to a brand new situation in which those ideas at best are marginally applicable and at worst simply have no relevance whatsoever. And I think that that's kind of what's going on. I think you see this in San Francisco, certainly see it in LA where I'm from. You know, it's just crazy, some of the stuff that people think is okay to get to do with fentanyl out there. And so I'm looking to places that are rethinking almost everything, because as I said, you know, fentanyl changes everything. And I think that's true for so many parts of the country now.
So would you say then that there's a space that can be created in dealing with this particular crisis where there can be a different level of punishment, in particular for those who are dealing the drugs, and also an opportunity to have a space that's safe and secure for someone who is addicted?
Yeah.
And it incorporates all the things that can help them.
That is happening.
Okay.
That is happening. Exactly. That's going on right now. That is what these jails are doing. People say, no, well, there's drugs in jail. Yeah, there are drugs in jail, just not in these pods. The reason is that people opt in and then they stay and then they become kind of cultured in the new environment that's not of the street. There's this definite movement away from the attitudes of the street, conniving, getting over, lying, et cetera, et cetera. It's all very connected to addiction and so on. And now in these pods, there are no weapons. There's no drugs. And so you're getting these experiments. The other thing about these jail experiments that I think are interesting, one that I wrote about at great length in The Least of Us, is that it doesn't stop in jail. And that's very, very important as well. The services start with your arrest. With that arrest, then you begin to detox. You spend significant months probably in this recovery center that you opt into, where you're around people in recovery. You're getting your brain back. You're getting a blessed respite from the dope. But then after that, there's a lot of attention paid to what happens to you when you get out. And that is a radical idea for most jails as well. When did you ever think of an American jail thinking about what happened to this guy when he leaves our gates, right? But that's going on now. And so there's all kinds of, signing people up for Medicaid. So they get drug treatment on the outside, medically assisted treatment. You're getting job placement, housing, NA and AA meetings, all these things. So it's a continuum of care, very much like what you get for, say, heart attack like I got, or cancer or whatever. You get a continuum care that does not just put a stent in you and say adios, you're on your way. It's where there's some things that you need to do and we'll help you do them. That's what's happening out of these jails. It's not throw you in jail and leave you.
This has been a fascinating conversation. I want to thank you so much for joining me on In Depth.
Mary, it's great to talk with you. Thank you for such thoughtful questions.
You can find this episode and past episodes of In Depth online at kcbsradio.com. You can also hear the episodes on the Odyssey app. Download the app on your smartphone and favorite KCBS radio. Thanks for listening. For KCBS and In Depth, I'm Mary Hughes.
You've been listening to KCBS In Depth. Get every episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Visit kcbsradio.com for more news and interviews. We are the Bay Area's news station, KCBS.